You're listening to a classic business podcast as heard on Classic 1027. 1027.
Well, during the peak of the first wave in South Africa last year, a study conducted by an academic consortium which became known as NIDS-CRAM offered policymakers unrivaled insights into almost real-time data and impacts of the coronavirus lockdown on households across the country. It gained global coverage for producing one of the very first detailed analysis of the economic effects of COVID-19 in a developing country anywhere. And the reports as part of Wave 1 published in July last year showed how the pandemic had made one of the world's most unequal countries even more so. Some 3 million South Africans had lost their jobs. And yesterday, Wave 3 was published, and the findings are equally fascinating and surprising, as the bounce back in jobs has been as impressive as the fall was frightening. More than 2 million South Africans found work between June and October of last year, according to the latest round of this data. But hunger and child hunger in particular persists, which is very curious. I'm joined now by two of the lead researchers, Nick Spall, an economist at Stellenbosch University, and Reeza Daniels, associate professor in the School of Economics at the University of Cape Town, and Rudy Dix, head of the project management office inside of the presidency. Welcome, chaps. Nick, just remind us what the sample for the study is, and can you just give us a quick insight into the attrition rates? Because there were 7,000, I think, interviewees in the first wave. How many have dropped out by wave three?
Sure. So of those 7,000 that we started with, whenever you run a panel study, you would expect that some people fall out between each wave. And because of some attrition in wave two, we actually did a top-up sample in wave three, where we successfully re-interviewed about 7,000. Of the 7,000 original, we successfully re-interviewed about 5,000 of those, as well as an additional 1,000 top-up. So this took us to a sample of about 6,000 people in wave three, which is lower than that starting number of 7,000, but still a significant number of South Africans.
Absolutely, and statistically significant, which is the important thing here. The headline is undoubtedly the strong employment recovery. There were, as you say, significant labour market adjustments, though, as you call it. But how can that be, given that we're expecting to see GDP decline by 7%? We've seen a lot of output decline in sectors like manufacturing and others that are hospitality, that are key employers. Just give us a bit of insight into that headline number of the strong bounce back.
Sure. So you must remember that when we're asking about employment, we're asking about it with reference to a specific month. And for wave three, that specific month was October. So when we reported those previous job loss figures, that between February and April, 2.8 million people lost their jobs, 2.7 million people lost their jobs. We now see 2.1 million people regaining employment or gaining employment. And that's just in the month of October that we're asking about. So in other words, between April and October, those 2 million jobs were gained. Now, that coincides with the lockdown changes that we see. So this was the first time that we had almost unrestricted economic access where people could go back to work. And that's only from October onwards. So things like the quarterly labor force survey, for example, the Q3 results that StatsSA released, the window that they're looking at is much wider than just that month. And therefore, they would have still been measuring a kind of locked down economy, whereas this was the first month that we had zero or level one lockdown, very few restrictions.
Right. And Reeza, to bring you in, and I'm sure you'll understand that there are likely to be many skeptics when they look at the numbers, but because it is a big surprise. Take me through the process and how you actually define employment here. Are you looking at specific hours? What sort of definitions of employment did you use?
Thanks for that. So we use the standard International Labour Organization definitions of employment. So that means someone has to be employed in terms of a contract with an employer, or in they can be self-employed. And that is how we will measure employment. So it's very similar to the way Statistics South Africa will measure employment. The only difference is that when we asked about a pre-February, pre-pandemic level of employment, we didn't ask about unemployment at about that time. And so the employment rates that we speak about are, especially from when we're comparing to February, they're looking at the employment as to population ratio. And so that's where it becomes very specific with respect to the number of employed relative to the population. Thanks.
Absolutely. And Rudy, to bring you in here, the survey did find that job recovery was stronger for those with more education, especially amongst the youth. I don't think too many surprises there, but clearly government must double down on its focus on education as a way to tackling unemployment. Broadly, though, at a headline level, what did you make of the data that was released yesterday?
Oh, I mean, I think you're right about that. Of course, generally data always shows that those with higher levels of education have better opportunities in either accessing, employment or being self-employed. And I think that's very important. So it is a focus. I mean, what is interesting about this results, because it's kind of like, as you reflect on it, Mike, the data is readily available, it asks the right sets of questions. Remember, it didn't only focus on the labor market, it also focused on issues around, hunger in the household, kids, education, ECD, and health. And that's important. That's important for us as policymakers to get a sense of what kind of impact that has and whether what we and how we respond. So I think that's the important thing. It did show that perhaps in the way that we dealt with employment and the way we opened up the economy and kind of the responses, particularly around keeping people in employment or furlough through the temporary employment release scheme has helped so that firms don't close down and we don't see a significant numbers coming through, but that people, as the lockdown phase, as we went down the lockdown phase of reducing the levels, you could see people coming back into full-time employment, being paid, and back into either providing services or production. So the policy choices that we make based on data is very, very important. And I say this to colleagues. I mean, we always get accused in government that we tend to make choices not based on evidence. And in this instance, I think the NISCRAM survey is very, very important for us. Irrespective of whether there's arguments about whether the bounce back around employment is as high as it is or not, I think it has helped us in making the right policy choices, and we think that has come through in the data through the way in wave three.
Because really that policy was about giving employers enough flex to deal with a momentary shock to the system, which a lockdown and a coronavirus pandemic was, this shock to the system, to give them the flex to deal with it. And to the other areas, which I find equally fascinating. And let's look at child hunger firstly, Nick. I mean, the worst child hunger in 10 years. And if you look at the employment findings, they were obviously a surprise. That really surprised me as well, because you would automatically assume that if people are now coming back to work, that child hunger would actually improve. Any reason or thinking as to why we're seeing child hunger at such poor levels?
Yeah, so that was a surprising finding for us as well. It's not what we would have expected going into it, and yet that is what we're seeing in the data. We see that household hunger increased from 16% to 18% when we're looking at up until the November period. And child hunger moved from 12% to 16%, which is that figure of 1 in 6 households with children that have a child that went hungry in the last week, which is, as you say, the highest that it's been in at least 10 years. It's even higher than the rate that it was at the hard lockdown in April and May, although it's not statistically significant. I would say the main policy thing that changed over this period, apart from the fact that people might have been running out of savings, they might have been running out of options to draw down, sell assets, those sorts of things, the big policy change obviously was the removal of the top-up grants to the child support grant and the old age pension, which stopped at the end of October. Mm. So when we were looking at this in November and December, when we asked people about hunger in the previous week, they wouldn't have had access to that 500 Rand top-up on top of the 440 Rand child support grant or the 250 Rand top-up on top of the about 1,800 Rand pension. So I think that's a huge question mark, is to what extent are the lack of these top-ups to the child support grant in particular contributing to child hunger, and what extent is rotational timetables where only half of kids are attending school and therefore only half of kids are getting school meals also contributing to child hunger?
I think that's a very important one as well. Rudy, would you like to just give us your thoughts as to government's thinking around that? Because there was a big controversy around closing schools and closing access to that one meal a day.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think that what the research does show is, Nick and his team have shown that perhaps what we should have done is perhaps design a more creative or innovative way of how we can deliver food to kids, all of them. So continue to sustain the program, but in a way that doesn't put kids and teachers at risk. I think that's a useful way that policymakers need to look at it from a point of view from from DBE, I think that's quite important. So there are some few recommendations coming out of one of the paper on how that should be considered. I mean, Nick's right, I think the choices of and the kind of trade-offs that one looks at from a government point of view was quite important. I mean, remember, towards the end of October, we took a decision to extend the SRD grant, which was the 350 special COVID grant. And that targeted about just under 6 million working age unemployed adults, right? And in a sense, what we did was to say, okay, well, you know, 6 million young, predominantly young people, women also, who haven't received any form of grant to get that. Now, I mean, again, one could have made a different choice and said, okay, we don't extend the SRD grant, or we limit and we introduce stricter criteria for who would be doing that. But certainly, I think that what it does show is that perhaps the targeting through a top-up grant, the caregivers grant, and the child support grant does show us in this instance, from the evidence, that that goes actually directly to the family, to the household, and that more food is being bought when those grants are given to caregivers, who predominantly women, or CSG grants that are collected on behalf of kids by women, and that it actually goes towards feeding households. And I think that's the kind of thing that we have to grapple with. I mean, again, from a fiscal point of view, and I know, you know, the researchers tell us, no, you know, we have to deal with this. But from a fiscal point of view, you know that, Mike, there are lots of trade-offs that we had to make, and this is the one of the trade-offs that we unfortunately had to make. But nothing stops us, and as we move forward, you know, there's a significant conversation in government around what sort of grant system are we going to, you know, what are the social protection measures for the future, given that we've seen the importance of social protection and targeting, you know, forms of social protection that can help us deal with hunger and deprivation and the kind of support that is needed from at least a policy response point of view.
Yeah. And it's so many points in that, Rudy, because I don't think anyone can argue with the fact that human dignity, the right to be able to survive, is something that we should all be aspiring to in South Africa. I don't think anyone could have argued against that, and why so many people are supportive of a basic income grant or an evolution of this SDR in some kind. And then the question becomes, well, how do you pay for it? You know, what are those trade-offs? But Riza, before we get into that, after the break, just talk to us about what the survey reveals about the grant system overall, because I'm not sure how many people actually realize that we really do lead the world when it comes to our social grant system, which is actually something we need to be very proud of in South Africa.
Yes, absolutely. And actually, I want to pass this question on to Nick, because he actually dealt a lot with the issue when he had to address some of the comments on the hunger section. Nick, perhaps do you want to take?
Yeah, happy to. Nick?
Sure. So what the paper, this is by Isan Basir and his co-authors, what their paper found was that more than 70%, 71% of South African adults are in a household that has access to some kind of government grant, which is really remarkable. And even the child support grant program reaches about 56% of households in South Africa. So half of South African households are in a household that has a child support grant. And to compare that to the equivalent system in Brazil and Mexico, the Oportunidades program or the Bolsa Familia, those only cover about 20% of households. So we really are having an extremely far-reaching and progressively targeted social grant system. And the social relief of distress grant that Rudy mentioned earlier, the 350 Rand grant, that reaches about 40% of households. But importantly, 10% of the households get no other grant. So 10% of households would previously were not in our social protection system and are now included in it because of that social relief of distress grant. And I think that's a big question mark when that gets removed, is those people will fall out of the social protection system. So I think that from a grant point of view, a lot of the questions are not saying, should we do CSG, should we do social relief of distress grant? It's sort of, we should have both. But the main critique of the social relief of distress grant is that it's disproportionately benefiting men, where about 60% of recipients are men, despite the fact that women are more likely to be unemployed. And that's because you can't hold that grant together with another grant, like the child support grant that many women hold.
The SRD grant does tend to disadvantage women who care for children. And you spoke earlier about the trade-offs that government has to make here. Can you just take me through how this is going to now impact your thinking about this grant going into the future? And a lot of talk about what happens when it's removed. Is government thinking about making this a permanent feature of the social grant framework?
So It's still a conversation within government. I mean, I think that government's view has always been that we need to develop a comprehensive social protection measure that deals fundamentally with the kind of impact of not being employed or not having any economic opportunity. So I might just say, sorry, I'm being an economist, but first prize, of course, is that we want employment. You know, we want people to find jobs, but where there are, of course, no opportunities, and, you know, we can't get, the economy going in the way that we are struggling, it's important that we have to find safety nets, and these are the kind of safety nets that are there. I think, let me just give you a bit of insight. The SRD grant, right, the Social Relief of the CES grant, is something unique and new that we have never done before. We've always had a conversation and debate within government about whether we target a universal income grant, and that goes back to, the Taylor report around the basic income grant. But for the first time, in the shortest possible time, using technology, we were able to develop a targeted grant. So we didn't look at a universality about it because it would have cost quite a bit of money, but we looked at it in a sense where we identified 5 to 6 million individuals that we were able to target. Now, that's important data. So we know that there's high levels of deprivation. We know that these are people that are struggling to find employment. We know where they are. We know where their gender is. We know the ID numbers, we know where they stay, and that's important. So that gives us a stepping stone to be able to deal with, unemployed working age adults, and particularly young unemployed working age adults, where, for example, there are significant distress. We have not taken a decision in relation to whether there's it's going to be a universal grant that is going to be taken up, but there's ongoing conversations around how one, introduces the kind of grant system in a way that it continues. There's lots of strong views and as it is that the SRD should continue, but government has made a clear decision that the SRD grant would extend for another 3 more months. I think it's quite important that this conversation is also taking place in NEDLAC with social partners, and what's important, so Nick and his team that provides the evidence and provides the kind of impact is what we require to inform that conversation and to make decisions about this. So I think this is this is what I could say. I know it's not the right answer, yes or no, but I think it's important for us to consider the evidence. What is it that we're going to do to be able to deal with those who fall through the cracks? And there are various options that are on the table right now.
Teach a man to fish is something that you wrote about, Nick. In an ideal world, you'd be able to teach those 10 million people who, all things being equal, are going to be out there looking for work. But the economy just doesn't have the opportunity. So in that environment, we have to think about how we provide these social safety nets, which comes to probably a concluding point for this panel. How do we fund it? And what are the government policy choices that are being made? Nick, what would you like to see in terms of solutions to help fund this kind of social security safety net?
So, I mean, I think the one thing that's quite clear is that further debt is probably not an option. Listening to National Treasury talk about this, and this was pre-crisis, pre-stimulus package, we were spending 15% of all government revenue was being spent on just paying for the interest of our debt, right? And next year, interest expenditure will be higher than health expenditure in South Africa. So I don't think that debt is another option. So our only options are reprioritizing existing spending and getting rid of vanity projects like South African Airways. It makes no sense to me why the government is running an airline. I've never heard a logical answer as to why the South African government should be running an airline and why we should be plowing 10 billion rand into bailing that out. But I think that bigger issues, because that's just one small issue, bigger issues around corruption, what's coming out of the Zondo Commission, and particularly state capacity, and making sure that the state actually has the capacity to implement its own plans, which I think at the moment is lacking. The way that government employs people is not primarily based on competence, and it's rather based on cadre deployment and political alignment, which means that they don't have the capacity to implement their own plans, which is why we hear about a lot of beginnings and announcements, but not as much about progress of existing ones. And then the last one, which is one that your listeners might be less amenable to, is to increase taxes. To introduce a wealth tax or to increase taxes that we already have. But that's also a precarious option because 95% of personal income tax and company income tax is being drawn from the wealthiest 5% of the population. 2.7 million people. So we have a very small tax base that we're relying on, but it may be the only option that's available given that debt is not an option and government has proven reluctant to restructure its spending.
And I think it comes back, and Rudy, I want to bounce this ball back to you, but it does come back to the social contract between the taxpayer and the government here. And I do think many who are fortunate to be in a position to be considered in the top 5% and paying 95% of personal taxes would not mind if that tax money was not being pilfered, wasted, or spent on vanity projects like SAA. So it comes back to the issue of, you know, what is government doing to tackle corruption and what is government doing to better reprioritize spending away from things like SAA and into much needed social safety nets that are evidenced by the NIDSCRAM study.
Or better opportunities for growing the economy, you know?
Yeah.
And that's true. Look, I mean, Mike, I mean, you know the answer. I mean, the point about it is that the president has made it fairly clear that we want to tackle corruption. This is the cornerstone of much of his priorities, including the issue of capacity and ensuring that we're able to deliver. So there's a lot being done to tackle the corruption. I think the perception out there is that we're not doing sufficient about it. But I think the president has it on his plate. He's made this an important objective of his in his term of office. And I think that's going to be quite an important. So you continue to watch the space. I think that the prosecuting authorities and the ability to have lots of commissions and asking ministers and senior leaders in provinces to account for wasteful expenditures are important steps. Mm-hmm. So we have to follow due process. You know, we can't just simply arrest and throw people in jail. Follow due process, have investigations, make sure that we tighten up. I think there's an honest commitment, for example, around how we do the rollout of the vaccines and how sourcing and procurement will happen around that. Again, I mean, I think it's important that there are obviously, you know, people in the system that try and game it. You know, people in the system that try and undermine and want to benefit, through malfeasance and a whole lot of different. The conversation around the priorities is an important area, Michael. And I mean, we've spent a great amount of time with National Treasury, and National Treasury is of course doing that we need to look at how do we spend on, projects that are long-term, that are sustainable, that are transformative, that builds the economy and locks in private sector investment. And that's really the priority that we need to look at. And at the same time, we have to sustain a large component, and Nick and them have done huge works around the, expenditure on the social side of the budget. And this is quite important that we need to sustain it. We need to spend better. Our programs need to be more impactful, and Nick's done quite a bit of work on that. And I think this is something that we need to look at. So the money is going in the right direction, but I think it's what we need to do better to improve our outcomes. And I think that's something that has been thrown, rightfully so, to government. You know, we need better capacity. We need people that are skilled. We need to have partnerships. We need to have adequate allocation of resources. You know, and we need to make tough trade-offs and choices. So if the choices is that we're focusing on growing the economy, on the reconstruction, and we want to continue to see support for the social sector, whether it's education or whether it's for social protection, then we need to ensure that these kind of measures are in place to be able to deal with that. But it's a different conversation. We can have that again, but I think it's important we're listening. I think for us, it's important that we continue and maintain that contract with the tax, with the taxpayer. You know, I think that's quite important that we do show we're trying to address fundamentally some of the concerns that have been raised, you know, not by the taxpayers alone, but by large components of society around areas of corruption or capacity or the inability to prioritize or not spending properly. No?
And we have seen that with the KPIs introduced into the ministerial agreements and the MOUs there, and we're going to be looking through those and certainly monitoring and holding those ministers' feet to the fire of accountability, because it comes from the top, it comes from the president. Just in the last 30 seconds, Nick, are you continuing the study from here? Clearly the pandemic, we'd like to wish it away, but it's still here. The vaccine rollout has just really begun with 80,000 shots, millions more still to go. What's next?
So there are still two more waves of NIDSCRAM, wave four and wave five. We'll be releasing wave four in April and wave five in July. So Riza and his team are actually collecting that data, and then in between the collecting, we obviously have to analyze the data before we publish it, and we are asking questions about vaccines and the willingness to take vaccines.
That's a very interesting point as well. Unfortunately, we don't have time to lead up on that and whether or not there is space to make receiving grants conditional around that area as well. But anyway, very interesting research by Nidz Kram, as always, in Wave 3. Lead researchers Nick Spall and Reza Daniels, and Rudy Dix, head of the Project Management Office inside the Presidency. That quarterly labour force survey for the fourth quarter is going to make for really fascinating reading.